We'll run the gamut today. Food, bad air, oil, and a trip to the dentist, in that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, I do believe the 15th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with food. As I said, one subject, two stories, where we go to eat it and where we go to buy it. Saw a report yesterday from the National Restaurant Association, so yes, lobbying group, but it says nearly 100,000 restaurants have either closed permanently or will be closed for the duration of this pandemic. That is one in every six eating establishments in this economy. Meanwhile, and possibly related, the number of people being hired back into the hospitality and leisure business has been getting lower and lower over the past couple of months, and almost 4.5 million jobs in that sector have not come back at all. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with the Dining Out Report.
Of Tracy Vaught's four restaurants in Houston, Texas, three are open.
I'm going to hang on. I'm hanging on no matter what.
They're only open at 50% capacity, reduced menus, reduced hours. The last one, though, has been closed for 6 months.
That's located in a hotel downtown in the convention district near the sporting arenas and a concert venue.
She says it just cannot stay closed much longer. She's going to try and open it up next month and see how it goes.
For a lot of restaurants, even when they are shut down, they're still paying fixed costs. They're still paying rent. They're still paying utilities. They're still paying insurance.
Sean Kennedy is with the National Restaurant Association. He says 8 weeks of financial support in PPP money that ran out months ago has not been enough. Yelp reports 31,000 restaurants on its platform have closed, the majority permanently. Restaurants have not been entirely helpless, though. Justin Norman is VP of Data Science at Yelp.
There are actually many businesses that have found a lot of new ways to innovate.
Moving to focus on delivery, selling meal or cocktail kits, dining outside, though that option will disappear in northern states as temperatures fall. Expect more innovation, says David Portalatin, industry advisor for the NPD Group.
We're going to start seeing a different kind of restaurant emerge in the future.
However you slice it, he says, the United States will end the year with fewer restaurants than it began with. And it's the larger chains that are more likely to survive. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, so that's going out to eat. If you stay home to cook, you got to buy groceries, right? And more of us are doing that online. Before the pandemic, online orders were just 2% of sales. Now they are at 20%, and everybody can read the handwriting on the wall. Walmart launched its new delivery subscription program today, which includes groceries. A lot of stores have added Instacart, and other apps like DoorDash have added groceries to their services. And then there is something called dark stores. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains what they may be telling us about the future of grocery shopping.
Companies like Whole Foods and Stop and Shop are building a new type of store. It looks like a regular grocery store, aisles of produce and pasta without fancy cheese towers or end-of-aisle displays.
And it doesn't have to look pretty because consumers are not going to be in the store, right?
Doug Baker is with FMI, a food industry association. Dark stores aren't open to customers. They're for fulfilling online orders, which have surged during the pandemic. And building them like regular markets, not warehouses, means they can be converted into stores if the trend doesn't hold.
You can build something for today, but you also need to think about what's the future.
Part of the reason the future is unclear is not everyone's online ordering experiences have been stellar. Terry Esper teaches marketing and logistics at The Ohio State University.
This integration of the online with the physical, carried along with it some very unique problems.
Maybe you order a specific cheese and you're sent a substitute that's $5 more. Just a hypothetical, of course. Or maybe you can't get a delivery slot. And for people who live outside a delivery zone, don't have reliable internet, or are on SNAP benefits, online grocery shopping may not be an option. Plus,
I think we shouldn't underestimate the human desire to engage in grocery shopping.
Hart Posen, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, thinks shoppers will eventually settle into a mix of in-store and online because the online stores don't let you pick the ripeness of your fruit. And they definitely lack everyone's favorite, free samples. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Random historical tidbit before we go on. 12 years ago today, 15th of September 2008, Lehman Brothers went under. Seems kind of like a really long time ago, doesn't it? On Wall Street this Tuesday, tech did real well. Everything else was mostly fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Air quality up and down the West Coast the past week or so, longer really in some places, has been just this side of actually toxic. We've all been told to stay inside, don't do anything strenuous, and generally just hunker down. Which is great if our jobs let us. A lot of jobs don't, though, obviously, and farm workers are still out in the fields keeping the food supply chain on track. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that.
Scenes in California's Central Valley in recent weeks have looked apocalyptic, according to Armando Alenis with United Farm Workers Union.
Your eyes start hurting. You think it's a fog with the sun being kind of blurry, orangey.
Already battered by COVID-19, he says farm workers are now spending all day in these conditions, which can cause severe respiratory problems and cardiovascular disease. But there's no specific federal safety standard to protect workers from the smoke. In California, when small particle pollution gets this bad, the state requires employers to provide workers with a filtering mask, you know, like the N95s that are pretty much impossible to get now.
They were all diverted towards healthcare purposes. And so we were experiencing significant difficulties.
Ryan Jacobson is the CEO of the Fresno County Farm Bureau. He says the state has given his office about 500,000 N95s to distribute. Last week, the United Farm Workers surveyed several hundred workers and found many still lacking a respirator. But at least California has standards.
It gives employers a really good roadmap that anybody can look at.
Debbie Berkowitz with the National Employment Law Project says other states could follow that lead. In Oregon, air pollution has been the worst in the world in recent days. Lawmakers there have considered a similar standard, with poor air quality expected to linger in some areas for weeks. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We are at 49 days till Election Day, if you're a traditionalist, because millions of people are going to vote long before that, already have, some of them, voting by mail or going to an early in-person polling place. And if you look at the polls, insert your favorite caveats about how we measure voter sentiment here, turning out new voters is going to be what really matters, which means a lot of people are spending a lot of money making sure the people on their side show up either in person or by mail. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has this one.
As early voting begins across the country, groups that focus on boosting voter turnout are spending more than ever trying to bring new voters to the polls. And that process can be pricey. Maria Teresa Kumar is president of Voto Latino.
In order for us to register a voter, it costs us $12.75. To get them out to the polls, it's an additional $3.
Scale that up to tens of thousands of people or millions of individual voter contacts, and it adds up. Plus, during the pandemic, the portion of that cost going towards getting a voter who's been registered to actually cast a ballot has gone up.
We have to spend more money now on education. That's going to be more than $3. That's probably going to be closer to $5 a person.
Kumar says the money is there. Her group raised $8 million in the last presidential election, and so far, it's more than doubled that. Outreach to rural voters is a similar story.
This is an unprecedented expenditure, tens of millions of dollars going into it, both in terms of research and in terms of independent expenditure programs we're seeing aimed at reaching rural communities.
Isaac Wright is a partner at the Rural Voter Institute, which aims to boost Democratic turnout.
But it's not enough, because that level of spending is going to have to be maintained if this is going to be long term.
Republicans have been making investments like that for years, says Liz Harrington, national spokesperson for the RNC, including about $300 million on beefing up their voter database.
So we had a huge operation that was still engaging, making phone calls and doing that virtually. But now that most states are open, we're doing it in a safe way and we're knocking on doors. We're doing over a million door knocks a week.
Harrington says the National Party is spending big on legal challenges around mail-in voting, doubling their legal budget to $20 million.
We certainly recognize that the absentee process will be used more than in previous years, but we are really using a lot of our outreach to encourage people to go to the polls in person.
Harrington says the responsibility for educating voters about how to do that is up to local party officials. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It also features a competitive lounge where the teams can review their gameplay and discuss strategy.
Who says esports aren't sports? First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, up literally just 2 points. Don't even know what that is percentage-wise. 27,995. The NASDAQ rose 133 points. That's about 1.2%, 11,190. The S&P 500 picked up 17 points, a little more than a half percent, finished at 3401. Kristen Schwab did grocery stores. Well, speaking of groceries and things you buy in those stores, shares in the Kraft Heinz company picked up 0.3% today after the company reported 2020 results would be better than expected. And then on the leftovers front, shares in Tupperware brands gained 10.5% today after an analyst released a bullish report on that company. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, turns 60 years old this week. But with the global economy changing as fast as it's changing, the energy sector, especially in the past decade or so, 60 is not exactly spry and agile anymore, you know? Daniel Yergin has spent decades explaining geopolitics through oil. His books, you might know, include The Prize and The Quest. He's also a vice chairman of the big research and information company IHS Market. His latest book on the state of play in the global energy economy is called The New Map. We got him, as you'll hear, at home a couple of days ago.
Wait, I got to get rid of a kitty cat.
That's all right. We'll take it all. You're going to hear my dogs here in a minute, too, so don't worry.
Okay. Yes, the world of pets.
I'll tell you what. I want to ask you, well, there's a lot of stuff I want to ask you about in this book, but I want to go to the section that you call America's New Map. And I want to point out, as you do in this book, that for decades, generations really, American foreign policy has been based around and on energy. And you write in this book that the last decade has really changed that. What do you mean?
The U.S. for half a century was preoccupied with the fact, from this point of view, that it was importing oil and had become the world's largest importer. And now it turns around, in a remarkably short time, the U.S. has become the largest producer of oil in the world. And that era of scarcity is over, that so dominated our foreign policy.
A lot of this, virtually all of this, you credit to the shale revolution and to that economic impact that it has had on this economy. Has to be said that there are environmental problems with fracking and getting shale out of the ground, and that comes in for some deserved criticism. But it has been, you say, an economic boom to this country that really deserves mention.
Yeah. Yes, I think on the environmental grounds, I was part of the commission that President Obama set up to look at shale and said if it's properly regulated, it's an industrial mm-hmm. activity, it works well. And that's been the case in general. There have been issues that have come up in specific circumstances. But the economic impacts, I think, are the things that are not recognized. Big impact on manufacturing in the Midwest, over $200 billion of investment in new factories, and it's created a lot of jobs. It means that basically money that went overseas into the sovereign wealth funds of countries instead has stayed in the United States and circulates in our economy.
What has it let us do, this ability to be energy independent? What has it let us do internationally and in the global economy?
What it's done is it's given flexibility to U.S. foreign policy. Whether you support President Obama's approach to Iran or President Trump's approach or what might be President Biden's approach, we have flexibility to deal with Iran that we didn't have before, because the Iranians thought that, you know, they had the high cards because the world couldn't do without their oil. But actually, the U.S., President Obama, put sanctions on Iran, and their oil was replaced by our oil. So that's, I think, a clear example of the impact.
Can't talk to Daniel Yergin without talking about OPEC and the cartel that has dominated the energy conversation for, well, since its founding, really. You say now that's not really the conversation to have, that the conversation to have in global energy is Russia, the United States, and the Saudis. Talk about that a little bit.
OPEC versus non-OPEC has been the sort of dominating motif in people's minds about how the energy, the oil world works. That's been overtaken by the fact it is dominated by really what I call the big three, what the United States does, what Saudi Arabia does, and what Russia does. Last April, when the U.S. economy and European economies were shut down and oil prices went negative, which is a hard concept to wrap your head around, it was the United States that really stepped in and made a deal to stabilize the market. And this, you know, you just couldn't have imagined this happening before.
Well, take the pandemic here for a second, because you are a guy who has spent his career thinking about energy and the future of this and the global economy. I wonder if the past 6 months since the pandemic started have made you just kind of throw up your hands and say, I don't even know now.
I think there's a lot of statements about how the world has been changed by the pandemic. I think it's still too soon because we're still in the middle of it, and we don't really know what the world will look like next, you know, when it's over. What we do know is how people work will have changed. On the other hand, you also see that people are kind of leery about going on public transportation right now, and there's been a surge in sales of used cars. So my reaction is when people say, this is definitely going to happen or that's going to happen, I say, it's too soon.
Daniel Yergin, you know him for many things. The new thing he's got coming is a new book called The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Dr. Yergin, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got an excerpt of Dr. Yergin's new book about the natural gas well in Texas where the fracking revolution actually began. We have it online, of course, marketplace.org. A couple of months ago, Erica Barris went to the dentist. She went to a lot of dentists, actually, trying to get a sense of how tough business was for those whose business model involves getting way up close and personal. Business wasn't great, as you might imagine, 3 or so months into a pandemic. So Erica has made the rounds again in search of dental hygiene in the new coronavirus normal.
Last time I spoke with Washington, D.C. periodontist Sally Cram, she was just getting used to being back in practice full time. Cram had spent around $20,000 to outfit her office for the pandemic. Air purifiers, sneeze guards, a washer and dryer for scrubs. Since then, she says, the cost of personal protective equipment, masks, gloves, gowns, has gone up.
Prior to all the COVID things, you know, I wore those anyway when I was doing periodontal surgery. And those disposable gowns were probably less than a dollar. And now I've seen them advertised on some websites and different places for $5 and $10 a piece.
Several of the dentists I spoke to mentioned that PPE costs have spiked, but supply has caught up to demand and commercial laundry services have ramped up. Because of the way Cram's appointments are staggered, her patient load is at 70% of what it was before the pandemic. That's just below the national average of 80%, which is where Colorado Springs pediatric dentist Jeff Call's practice is.
Not perfect by any means, but certainly much better than it was when I last talked to you.
But business is booming for some dentists, including Kirk Nobo in Purcellville, Virginia. Since he reopened his practice in early May, he's hired 2 new assistants because so many patients are coming in.
I know August numbers, we're ahead of where we were last year at this time, which says a lot.
But even though patients are lining up to come in, Atlanta area periodontist Peter Schatz says they're way more worried about their finances than they were before the pandemic. They tell him,
look, you know, insurance was going to cover doing an implant, but now I got to pay cash because I'm out of work. What else can we do?
He says more often than he did in the past, he has to offer lower cost alternatives. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Colleges have been back in session for a couple of weeks now with varying degrees of success, coronavirus-wise. But even on campuses with students physically there, there are some things missing. Full-on big-time athletics among them. But that has not stopped all competition. There's still esports. Marketplace Jasmine Garst has that one.
They're really willing to take the fight a little bit more than I would have anticipated. All right.
That's Rutgers playing against Cal Poly Pomona at the ESPN Collegiate Esports Heroes of the Storm Championship last year. Rutgers won, by the way. Michael Fay directs Rutgers Esports Center.
A lot of the esports activity that we have been hosting in person can also take place entirely online without impacting pretty much any of the operations.
Rutgers built its center last year. It features 60 state-of-the-art gaming PCs as well as
the broadcast studio in the back where we broadcast all of our competitions. And then it also features a competitive lounge where the teams can review their gameplay and discuss strategy.
The center never opened because of the pandemic, which might be the least of Rutgers' financial problems right now. The school could lose tens of millions of dollars in potential revenue without a football season. Michael Brooks, executive director of the National Association of Collegiate Esports, says shifting focus to esports is not going to fill that hole.
Esports, yes, there is revenue that's out there. Is it anywhere close to what the bigger schools with basketball and football are seeing normally? The answer is no. It's not there. It's not even close. We're still trying to figure out what revenue models are out there.
He says it could come from tickets to watch players compete online, corporate sponsorships, or donations. Setting up some top-end computers and a training center won't cost nearly as much as a football stadium, but that initial investment for schools that don't already have esports programs, it's too risky when budgets are getting cut, says Anthony Hennen, who writes about higher education at the James G. Martin Center, a conservative think tank.
I don't think there's actually been a really good case study showing that there's been any profit coming from these things yet.
More schools are trying to get esports programs started. Since the pandemic, there's been an uptick in colleges asking the Association of Collegiate Esports how it all works. But Hennen says it's not clear that fans who usually watch traditional sports will reroute their passion to esports.
I don't imagine many baby boomers are going to give up on NCAA football and instead pivot to watching, you know, their local university play on Twitch.
Esports teams are somewhat affected by the pandemic. Some matches used to happen with both schools in the same arena, which, yeah, not happening.
We're not going to have as many competition matches as much due to COVID.
Tyler Salinitro is a freshman at Marietta College in Ohio. He's there on an esports scholarship. Nearly 200 U.S. colleges offer around $15 million per year in scholarships, according to the Esports Association. Not every player on the team has a good enough computer at home or in their dorm. So he masks up and goes to Marietta's esports center.
We have put up barriers between the PCs so that we're able to have more people in the room to practice for the different teams at a time.
Salinitro is looking forward to several tournaments just this month, and he dreams of going pro. His coach, Matthew Williamson, says
more people are getting invested in watching people play video games, and we're seeing that same hype trickling down at the collegiate level.
Williamson thinks just like the fan base for professional teams is growing, it's only a matter of time for colleges. And with traditional sports at Marietta and other schools on hold for the rest of 2020, time may be on esports' side. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, make of it what you will. You can add the Senate and the House of Representatives to those organizations not getting on President Trump's payroll tax deferral bandwagon. Remember, that's the president's executive order letting companies not collect the tax now through New Year's, but said taxes would still be due and payable January through April 2021, so you would eventually have to pay them. Federal courts are opting out as well. Active duty military and all civilian employees of the executive branch are having their taxes deferred, whether they want to or not. All right, we are out of here, but here is your Tuesday dose of economic context, courtesy of a Census Bureau report out today. Before the pandemic, which is to say, like, forever ago, the Census Bureau says a record low percentage of Americans were living in poverty, 10.5% of us in 2019. Yes, obviously, still too high, but the fifth year in a row, that number has gone down. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.